Hello, and you're very welcome to the last programme in the current series. Coming up, whatever happened to the hole in the ozone layer? The puzzling disappearance of honeybees, a possible vaccine against liver fluke infection, and the burren in full bloom a month earlier than usual. But we begin with water pollution. Now, the main worry in Ireland in recent weeks is, of course, cryptosporidium. But for some years now, scientists here and elsewhere are concerned at rising levels of some chemical pollution, especially the gender-bending chemicals, as some of them are called, and they can, for example, cause male fish to become more female. That's because these chemicals can disrupt the endocrine hormone system. They're called endocrine disruptors, and they can be found in things like paints and plastics, in industrial and pharmaceutical effluent, and even, I gather, in sunscreen lotions. Now, the situation in Ireland is being studied by a team at the Lone Institute of Technology, and they're working with the EPA, that's the Environment Protection Agency. And joining me from our Athlone studio is team member and research student Miriam Kelly. Miriam, I mentioned a few of the sources of these chemicals. Where else can they come from?
Indeed, Mary, there are a number of different routes where these chemicals can get into our waterways. You mentioned pharmaceuticals. A lot of people wouldn't realise, but the major component of the contraceptive pill is ethanol estradiol and is also a cause of endocrine disruption. Again, personal care products, sunscreens, cosmetics, and more worryingly, children's toys. We have the incidence of phthalates, which are plasticisers. They're added to children's toys to impart a certain flexibility. But the problem is something as little as a rise in temperature, or indeed children putting the toys into their mouths, can encourage these chemicals to leach from their matrices and result in children having a certain level of these chemicals being ingested.
So children can get them from sucking, say, a soft plastic soother. Women are taking the contraceptive pill. But how do the chemicals then get into our water supplies?
Through the effluent systems, a certain amount of them are non-biodegradable, so they will persist in the environment. Again, we have the case of agricultural runoff, where you have the use of pesticides, in particular herbicides. All of these will ultimately end up in our water supply.
Intriguing. Now, there have been headline stories from other countries of, I've heard of, I think it's male fish becoming more female, female animals developing penises and so forth. Have we seen anything like that in Ireland in your studies?
When looking at feminisation of fish, we need to look at two key indicators, and we have been studying these indicators at AIT. The first are the detectable levels of vitellogenin. Now, vitellogenin is an egg yolk protein which is found in female fish, and we have found these levels in male fish. Now, the second would be the presence of intersex. Now, we have not found intersex in Ireland, but what we have found are delayed spermatogenesis and reduced testicular size in brown trout.
So you're seeing some changes, but perhaps not the kind of gross changes that we're seeing in other countries. Is this something we should be worried about in Ireland, do you think?
Well, with every country which experiences certain industrialisation, I mean, for example, the UK has had certain instances of intersex, and maybe we already have it here in Ireland. It's just not been detected yet.
So more surveys perhaps needed?
That would be advisable, yes.
And the big question, I suppose, then, is what can be done about this?
Well, because it's a global problem, Mary, it's not just within Ireland or in the UK. It's a global issue. And there have been many suggestions put forward. One would be the incorporation of an activated carbon treatment system into the water. People might worry about these having excess costs, etc. But the fact is these treatment systems are in use in household water filters and fish tanks already.
So possible treatment improvements that might help remove those chemicals from the water supply. Research student Miriam Kelly, thank you. That's Miriam Kelly from the Environmental Toxicology Research Team at Athlone Institute of Technology. You're listening to The Quantum Leap with me, Mary Mulvihill. Still to come, the puzzling disappearance of honeybees and a possible vaccine against liver fluke infection. But now, whatever happened to the hole in the ozone layer? Back in the 1980s, the hole in the ozone layer was the big environmental worry. The ozone layer protects us from damaging ultraviolet radiation, but it was being destroyed by chlorine that was being released high in the atmosphere from industrial chemicals called chlorofluorocarbons, or CFCs. These were widely used in things like aerosols and fridges, among other things. Now, an international treaty, the Montreal Protocol, was drawn up 20 years ago in 1987, and that was designed to ban the use and release of the CFCs. Just how successful has it been, and what's happened to the hole in the ozone layer? To find out, I asked atmospheric chemist Professor Howard Sidebottom at UCD.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Whatever happened to the ozone hole, it's still there and is larger than it was when it was making media headlines.
Is it getting any better, or when will it get better?
It's going to get worse for the next 5 or 10 years, but it's self-healing. The original problem, when it was originally discovered or proposed back in 1974, it was realised that chlorofluorocarbons would degrade in the stratosphere, the chlorine atoms would destroy a great deal of ozone, and it was a proposal. The problem with that science was these compounds have an atmospheric lifetime of over 50 years, so that when you say there's a problem and you turn the tap off, it will actually get worse for the next 50 years before it heals itself. So the problem really was in 74 when Molina and Rowland proposed this. They were making a prediction, and there was no way you could experimentally do it, measure the depletion, except by waiting. And broadly what happened was people worried about it, checked the science looked all right, industry and government said, well, there's no experimental evidence, and it's going to cost a lot of money to rectify. And then what happened, people in Antarctica, looking at ozone above Antarctica, for no real reason except scientific
curiosity.
curiosity, suddenly discovered that, and this was in the early 80s, there was a relatively large depletion above Antarctica with the ozone hole. And this was not predicted. It turned out that Antarctica, because of its particular climate, was actually an amplifier. So by the early 80s, people realised that Rowland and Molina had sort of got their chemistry a little bit wrong, and nobody had picked it up. But actually, they got it wrong on the safe side. And at that stage, industry and government realised that something had to be done.
So the hole in the ozone layer has still to get worse for a couple of years before it will start improving, and hopefully by the end of the century will have healed.
The middle of this century, it'll be getting sort of back to normal, and by the end of this century, it'll be where it was. And it's an example of science, industry and government cooperating, realising there's a problem, industry doing something about it and realising it will cost money. And actually the problem was solved.
Now, you mentioned Antarctica was, in a sense, the worst hit, but there's also a similar thinning of ozone over the Arctic. And because it's a spring phenomenon, I think because of temperatures and cloud formation and so forth, does that mean there's a thinning of the ozone layer over Ireland at the moment?
Yes, once in Antarctica, where it's much more serious, the air is very stagnant around Antarctica in their winter. The same thing happens over the Arctic, but it's not as cold. And that ozone hole breaks up periodically, and ozone-deficient air would, for example, arrive above Ireland. And therefore, in Ireland, Northern Europe, the incidence of UV radiation is slightly higher than it would be.
But not something you think we should be worried about?
No, not at all.
The relative success of the Montreal Protocol, which banned CFCs, which means that, OK, it's going to take the guts of another 50 years before we see a healing of the hole in the ozone layer, does it make you optimistic about being able to tackle what is the current big problem of climate change and global warming?
In some ways, yes. It's a similar type of problem, except the ozone hole problem, banning CFCs, refrigerants. There were ready-made replacements. That's what industry did. It produced a new range of compounds which don't have this climate effect. The same thing would be nice to say about global warming, but there isn't a ready-made replacement for fossil fuels. And that's the real problem. Solving the CFC problem was expensive but doable. Solving this problem is very expensive and will change our lifestyles. Putting a different refrigerant in your refrigerator, you've still got a refrigerator.
That was atmospheric chemist Professor Howard Sidebottom in UCD, and you can find more about this topic at a dedicated website, theozonehole.com. Very good. Now, staying with environmental change, which seems to be something of a theme for this final programme of ours, and now to the puzzling disappearance of honeybees. Beekeepers across North America and even in Europe are mystified at the sudden disappearance of billions of their worker bees. In some cases, 90% of hives have reportedly been wiped out. They're calling it colony collapse disorder, and perhaps the most worrying aspect is that people have no idea why it's happening. Honeybees are very important in pollinating crops, so it's a potentially very big problem, and already it's prompted a congressional hearing in the US. Well, joining me on the line now is the PRO for the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, Philip McCabe, himself a bee expert. Philip, first, just to clarify, what are the beekeepers seeing? Are they seeing millions of dead bees or empty hives?
They're seeing empty hives. What happens is it's kind of scary, because sometimes if the bees die for a particular reason, you see the dead bees on the floor of the hive, and then you can actually take them and analyse them. But what's happening in America particularly is that the bees are absconding. Now, bees can abscond for a number of reasons, but when they're absconding at a particular time of the year for no reason, this is what's really worrying many people. In Ireland at the moment, we've had a number of experiences where beekeepers went to their hives, and you may have 10 or 12 colonies in a locality or in an apiary, and they open up two hives, and there's absolutely no bees whatsoever in the hive, so dead or otherwise.
Now, I know it's been widely reported in the US, so you're saying it's already being seen now in Ireland?
I mean, I suppose, look at it as something new, because across Europe it's been a phenomenon for the last 15 years. I mean, we've been talking about it for years. Because it's so big in America now, it's getting notoriety in the media, but it's been around for a long time. If it's getting bigger, that might be a situation we now have. But I would have had hives in the past over my lifetime where I'd go to the hive and there'd be nothing at all in it, and I'd wonder why. Now, if there's no bees there, then you can't catch, you can't analyse the bodies, that you can't carry out a post-mortem, as it were, on what's left behind. But in America, at the present time, it's a major problem. But it's major because over there, it's not like Ireland. In Ireland, we have hobbyist beekeepers, people like myself, other beekeepers. Beekeepers have anything from one to maybe 50 hives, usually less than 10. But there's a good few of us who would have 50 or 60 hives. Now, we would see it would have a bigger impact on us than it would have on the beekeepers with one or two hives, because they can look after and mind their hives, and there's less work involved. What we believe, and I think one of the problems we have now, is the whole global warming thing, stress. Now, stress is something that, you know, you talk about bees, how can they be stressed out? In America, what's being happening is commercial beekeepers in America, they get their money by pollination from the use of bees for pollination.
So they hire out their hives to farmers to pollinate the crops.
Yeah, they're interested in honey, but honey's really sort of a sideline. If they get honey, it's a bonus. If they don't, it's not a problem. They're getting their money because they're bringing the bees on large trucks across the prairies to pollinate crops, and they're following crops, as it were. So with the seasonal changes that takes place, from the Canadian border down to the Mexican border, beekeepers that I know personally myself, they would have two or three articulated trucks carrying several thousand, like adding up to 15, 20,000 hives in a run.
And they're moving north as the crops mature.
Correct. They're moving up or down. And when they get north, then they come to the end of the season, and then they have a short space of time in a winter locality or a winter apiary, and then they're moving south again, or whatever the case may be. But if you're taking bees from crop to crop, I have always believed that the movement of the bees, that's not what bees were designed to do in themselves when they're around longer than ourselves. We're now pushing them to do things that I don't really think is in their genes. So I believe that stress, the spraying of crops, pesticides, there's a whole range of things. There's a smaller range of pollens available now. The decrease in the biodiversity of the crops that are out there. You have huge acreages, like, I mean, talk prairies full of oilseed rape or alfalfa, but then there's no other pollen there as well. And bees like a mixture.
Okay, so a range of factors that you think might be responsible for what they're seeing in North America. What about any idea what's causing the colony disappearances that are seen here in Ireland?
I personally believe it's to do with sprays, pesticides. That is always my belief. If my hives get hit, or if my bees fly into a crop spring, whatever it may, or if fly into an area and they bring back some pesticide to the hive, bees operate by scent. And if it's the case you suddenly have a few bees dying, if there's something has come into the hive that shouldn't be there, if the bees know to survive, they've got to get out themselves, and they go. Now, they'll end up dying somewhere else because they probably won't have a home, and if it's the early time, this time of the year, they probably would survive. But if it's late autumn, they've no hope of surviving because they've no honey, they've no stores or no food for themselves, and they'll die out over the winter somewhere else, maybe in a hole in a hedge somewhere or in a wall of a part of a tree or wherever they go.
Okay.
But I think pesticides are a big problem.
Okay. That's Philip McCabe, who's the PRO for the Federation of Irish Beekeepers. Philip, thank you for taking our call, and I suppose relieved to hear that things aren't as bad in Ireland as they are in North America. Now, from bees to the problems that affect some larger livestock and liver fluke infection, which has been a serious problem for Irish farmers for many years now. But now scientists in University College Dublin are fighting back. To hear how the battle is going, we sent reporter Terry Flanagan to talk to Professor Grace Mulcahy and hear what progress is being made and how close they are to developing a vaccine.
The liver fluke or Fasciola hepatica is a big problem in Ireland. It does affect cattle and sheep, and farmers spend quite a lot of money on drugs in order to be able to control this parasite, particularly in the west of the country. And because the west of the country has a higher water table and more rainfall, it's more of a problem there.
Can you give us an idea of how much damage it does?
Oh, enormous damage. Basically, the parasite migrates from the intestine of the animal through the peritoneal cavity and through the abdomen into the liver, and it munches its way through the liver tissue all the way before finally coming to rest in the bile duct of the animal. And clearly, the damage done to the liver can affect the animal's ability to make protein. It affects the blood of the animal, so animals which are infected become anemic. Sheep are more susceptible to severe disease than cattle, and it's not uncommon to find sheep dead quite suddenly if they have a heavy infection from liver fluke. In cattle, then, the effects tend to be a little bit more subtle, but in the long term, dairy cows, for example, can suffer losses in milk yield and lowered fertility if they're infected with the liver fluke. So it is a severe clinical problem and one that's very difficult to control.
And tell us a little bit then about your research here in UCD.
Well, we've been working on liver fluke for a good number of years now, and we have both applied and basic projects which are focusing on the parasite. In terms of the basic projects, what we're interested really is the effect the parasite has on the immune system of the host. And it's well known that worm parasites like liver fluke have a very strong ability to be able to change the way the immune system of the host reacts and how it deals with other diseases which may be going on at the same time.
So what you're saying then is if an animal is infected with liver fluke, it's dampening down its immune system towards a secondary infection.
Well, the results of our research indicate that that can be the case. And one of the interesting models we're looking at is the possible effect of liver fluke on the response of animals to tuberculosis. And of course, bovine tuberculosis is a problem in Ireland. It's at a very low level in the national herd, but it hasn't been completely eradicated. And one of the reasons it's very difficult to eradicate, of course, is that there is a wildlife reservoir of infection, and the badger is one of the important sources of this infection. But we're not sure that that's the whole story. And we've got evidence to suggest, for example, that animals, cattle, which are infected with liver fluke, do not respond in the same way to some of the tests used to diagnose bovine tuberculosis as do normal uninfected animals. And we've been looking at the ways in which the parasite can affect the response to these tests. And we know that the parasite, for example, or proteins produced by the parasite can alter the way one particular cell type, the macrophage, behaves.
Now, the macrophage, that's the white blood cell.
It is a white blood cell. It's a white blood cell that is involved in phagocytosis, or engulfing or eating up bacteria that have found their way into the bloodstream.
They do it something like Pac-Man, is that right?
That's right, yes. And it's also a cell which is involved in the response of cattle to the intradermal skin test for tuberculosis. And we found that if you take cattle which are infected with the liver fluke, with Fasciola hepatica, their macrophages lose the ability to become activated or being able to kill bacteria. Instead, they have a completely different kind of response. They go on another pathway altogether, and the macrophages of these infected animals are more like macrophages or cells which are involved in repair to host tissue and are involved in dampening down inflammatory and immunological responses. So we've been studying in some detail the way this happens, what pathways are involved, and what molecules that the parasite produces which are capable of interacting with the macrophages in this way. And we would like to very much continue on that and to see in a more large scale way whether or not the liver fluke has a real effect on the ability of cattle to deal with tuberculosis and other important bacterial infections and indeed viral infections as well. So that's the basic research we're doing. In terms of applied research then, what we're doing is we're looking at ways to develop a vaccine that could protect cattle and sheep.
Now, there is no vaccine at the moment.
That's right.
You really just have to wait until the cow or the sheep shows signs of liver fluke infestation and then you treat it.
We know a lot about when and where a disease is likely to occur. So most farmers would have a planned approach to this. They would know what times of the year you need to treat. They would know what land is risky from the point of liver fluke infection. So they'd have a planned treatment program. But the problem is that many of the drugs which are most effective against liver fluke are becoming less so. And this is because since the drugs have been used for a good long time now, the parasite populations have had time to adapt to them. And they have developed resistance to some of these drugs. The other factor is that this parasite is one which is changing in terms of its epidemiology. In Ireland, we've always had a lot of it. But in the UK, for example, they've seen fairly dramatic rises in the prevalence and the numbers of these parasites which are around. And we're not quite sure of the reasons for this, but climate change and wetter and milder winters may certainly be a factor. So, yes, we think going forward that vaccination is going to be a good way of controlling the disease.
What stage are we at now in the development of a vaccine?
We have shown that we can use molecules which are the same as parasite molecules, but which are recombinant, which are produced in bacterial or yeast systems. And we can show that if we use these as vaccines in cattle, we can have a very significant protective effect in these cattle against liver fluke infection. So we can prevent about 60% to 70% of the parasites developing in vaccinated animals. Now, we still have an amount of work to do in optimising the vaccine. So, for example, we're looking at things like how long does the immunity generated in vaccinated animals last. We're looking at what the optimal dose of the protein is, and we're looking to how we can enhance the immune response of animals to the protein so we can have the best possible vaccine.
And how close are we to getting a vaccine that will be on the market?
It's very difficult to say. I think it's very difficult to produce an effective vaccine against a parasite which is so complex. Like the liver fluke. This is a very big, very large worm if you compare it to the size of, say, a virus or a bacteria. So I would think we have maybe 3, 4, 5 years' work left to see if we can get this vaccine.
And finally, Professor, if I was to ask you, can you see a day in the future, or when in the future can you see a day, that there'll be no liver fluke present in Ireland?
I think that day is not going to come. There are lots of different parasites that we could contemplate eradication strategies for. The liver fluke is not one of them. And the reason for that is that the liver fluke will live quite happily in a number of different animal hosts, not only livestock like cattle and sheep, but also wild animals as well. So deer, for example, rodents, any other species you can think of almost, will also harbour liver fluke. And quite clearly, we're not going to be vaccinating all of those. I don't think, no, we're ever going to see the liver fluke eradicated. But I do think that we will have a day coming quite soon when we'll be able to control it by vaccination.
Terry Flanagan there, talking to Professor Grace Mulcahy in University College Dublin. And finally, it's time for our weekly look at the natural world. And it used to be said that if you wanted to see the burren flowers at their best, then the time to go was the 3rd week of May. But this year, it seems, the burren is in full bloom a month early. Joining me on the line from Kinvara is burren expert Dr. Brendan Dunford. Brendan, what's in flower there at the moment?
Well, Mary, as you said, it's been a much earlier flowering season this year, and we have a fairly full suite of burren flora in flower at the moment. We have the spring gentians, plenty of them, scattered around the burren at the moment. And also we have a very early showing of the mountain avens, the other characteristic burren plant, that lovely alpine plant that you'll find growing on roadsides and across the pavements and grasslands of the burn. And of course, as well, we have the first of the season's orchids, the many orchids that we find in the burn. At the moment, you have the early purple orchid in flower fairly profusely, again, across the burn. And you've other little specialities like the cat's paw, milkwort, tormental, birds with trefoil, all those little plants, which you'd expect to see probably in the first week or so of May, yet they're here in mid-April this year.
In mid-April, you make it sound lovely. Is that alongside all the traditional spring woodland flowers?
Yeah, you'll see. The good thing about visiting right now is you get a flavour of the summer flora, but you also get a look back at a lot of the spring flora, the shade-loving plants, primrose family, wild garlic, anemones, sorrel, violets, barren strawberry, plants like that you'll normally find in woodland areas before the leaves come on the trees.
And Brendan, is it the warm April or the mild winter?
I think it's been a very, very warm and dry and mild April. We've had about 5 weeks until this week without rain and very calm weather as well. So ideal for butterflies as well. And you'll see brimstone, speckled woods, peacocks, common blues flying around at the moment, enjoying, I suppose, a fine spell of weather. Hasn't been good news for everybody, of course. A lot of the farmers have had problems with drought up in the burn because of the karst environment. There's been no water there for cattle, but I suppose for the visitor to the burn, it's really ideal weather conditions for appreciating the flora.
OK, on that note, Brendan Dunford, thank you. So that's it. Head for the burn over the coming weeks. Bring a camera and, of course, don't pick the flowers. That's nearly it for this week and indeed for this series. Now, as always, you'll find more information about the items in this week's programme on our programme website at rte.ie. Just follow the links to Radio 1. But that's it for the current series of The Quantum Leap. We hope to be back in the autumn with a new series. Until then, from me, Mary Mulvihill, and series producer Peter Mooney, have a good summer and slán.